Chapter 3. The Nature of Giving. Moreover, Subhuti, a bodhisattva who gives a gift should not be supported by a thing, nor should he be supported anywhere. When he gives gifts, he should not be supported by sight objects, nor by sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. According to Vasubandhu, who produced an early and authoritative commentary on the Diamond Sutra, giving here is meant to stand for or embody all the six perfections, giving, morality, patience, vigour, meditation, and wisdom. How might this be so? We may say firstly that by practicing morality and patience, you give protection and security to other living beings, or at least to a limited number of them, by virtue of the fact that you are not actually assaulting them, or robbing them, or running off with their wives and daughters, or deceiving them, and by virtue of being forbearing with respect to their weaknesses. We may also say that you give protection to others by imparting confidence and inspiration through your own personal practice of morality and patience. Secondly, you can give the gift of the Dharma only on the basis of practicing vigour, meditation, and wisdom, rather than by just handing out uplifting little tracts, say. To give the gift of the Dharma extensively, constantly, or on an extensive scale, does require tremendous energy, and to give it at all is just not possible without some degree of mental clarity, not to speak of insight. So a fair case can be made for presenting giving, dana, as the embodiment of all the perfections, at least from a certain point of view. This said, we may usefully remind ourselves of what giving means in its straightforward sense. The Mahayana was quite concerned at one stage with the question of wealth in this regard, inasmuch as it was thought hardly possible to practice dana paramita if you had no material wealth to distribute. To people who do not have very much to give on the material front, it may seem like rather a splendid idea to start giving in more refined ways, giving encouragement, giving one's time, even giving the Dharma. But that level of giving is simply beyond the capacity of many people to carry out to any very helpful degree. To be able to give on the ordinary common sense level, we do generally need a little spare cash. If we can manage to earn enough from the work we do to give away part of our earnings, without martyring ourselves, of course, this is very often the best way to practice dana. A bodhisattva, the Buddha tells Subhuti, should not be supported anywhere. At one level, this obviously means that one should practice giving, or indeed any of the perfections, without thinking of the merit accruing from one's actions. There is little more to it than that, however. It is not just that bodhisattvas perform virtuous actions without the slightest impure motive. The point is that they see those actions and their own merit as empty. But how do we approach this idea in practice? To be supported means that you are resting on something, either something you can touch, hear, smell, or taste, or an idea, a concept, a mind object. You are placing your whole weight on it, relying on it, taking it literally, taking it at its face value, placing your whole confidence on it, almost going for refuge to it. The way to avoid being supported in this way is not to allow our thinking to be totally determined by the immediate subject matter of our perception. We are not being expected to do without concepts of things altogether, but we should not treat those concepts as anything more than provisional. We should use concepts, but not settle down in them. If we are going to develop this bodhisattva-like attitude to concepts, we need to make sure that we do not allow our thinking to be ruled by the apparent objects of our perception. When you are asked a question, you can choose either to reply in terms of the question or to go beyond the terms of the question in answering it. Your answer can be limited to the question, but not limited by it. The bodhisattva would not allow the terms of the question to lay down the terms of the reply. In the same way, sense data may be put in questions, saying things, But the Bodhisattva does not allow his or her response to be determined by the sensory input. The Bodhisattva goes beyond it because he or she is bigger than sense data or mind objects. More simply, suppose you were idly to take a snapshot of a landscape which a great artist had also taken for a subject. The print you got back from the chemist would reproduce that landscape in as precise a way as the chemical process would allow, but the end result would be limited by that process. The artist, on the other hand, would bring himself or herself into the equation, refusing to be limited by appearances, and might well see and portray something more than was given. Generally speaking, the artist needs expertise in representing the appearance of things in order to create an image that transcends appearances. Similarly, the Bodhisattva does not evade rational thought and the questions it raises, but is at the same time prepared to go beyond those questions. We find the same principle at work in the meditation on the six elements, in which, far from denying our involvement with the material world, we in fact minutely examine the various components of our material existence. Our aim in doing this, however, is to realize that we are greater than these components, that our being transcends them, or at least the first five elements, and to reassert, so to speak, our original being. The practice of Dana Paramita is to give as an expression of one's innermost nature. Giving a gift unsupported means giving whatever is appropriate to the situation, even to the extent of sacrificing life and limb, with no more self-consciousness than that of someone passing the salt across the dinner table. It might almost surprise you if someone were to thank you for giving everything you have, because you are doing nothing special from your point of view when you are just, so to speak, being yourself. It would be as though someone were to come up to you after dinner and say, "Thank you for passing the salt." So we can practice being less deliberately, less self-consciously, less heavily virtuous, not letting our left hand know what our right hand is doing, as Jesus put it. And of course this applies to all the paramitas. We need to understand that the practice of giving, ethics, patience, vigour, meditation and wisdom is the expression of our own deepest need. One of the many criticisms that the ancient Egyptians used to have of the ancient Greeks, and in those days the ancient Greeks were decidedly modern, not to say brash, was that they had developed gymnasia, basically because they were not getting enough exercise in the course of their everyday life. From the Egyptian point of view, this amounted to an admission on the part of the Greeks that they were living in an artificial, unhealthy, unbalanced way. The same view may be taken of the practice of religion. If it is not inherent in the way that we go about the ordinary daily business of life, there is something amiss. Now, you might say that if the Egyptians had been really balanced themselves, they would not have needed temples, but this is to take an inappropriately modern view of the function of temples. For the Egyptians, the gods were real, and the temples were simply where they lived and where people served them. In ancient Egypt, to be religious was not a particular style of life, nor was religious activity something to be superimposed upon ordinary life. This principle is one of the themes of Lao Tzu in his Tao Te Ching. Just as Lao Tzu would call the development of a code of morality a degeneration, so we may look askance at the idea of specifically religious acts. If you have some money and someone else has none, it should be possible to share that wealth between you with no more thought than a flower gives to blooming. Instead, however, there is so often the tendency to practice religion in the manner of, to borrow Dr. Johnson's famous or possibly infamous image, a dog walking on his hind legs. Trained for years, he probably does it quite well. He probably totters about on his hind legs better than any dog in town, and is a credit to his master, but it remains a highly artificial performance. It is just no use putting our unredeemed doggy nature on his hind legs and stalking along in front of an admiring crowd, thinking, well, so this is the spiritual life. There is no point in making a big thing of being a great bodhisattva practicing great virtue. It is because we have got ourselves into such a profoundly irreligious, unskillful state that we have to think in terms of religion and morality at all. For Subhuti, the bodhisattva, the great being, should give gifts in such a way that he is not supported by the notion of a sign. Notion is a translation of sannyā, which is one of the five skandhas, and means, in that context, something more like recognition. Suppose, for instance, you were to perceive in the distance something green and of a certain recognizable shape and size, so that you were able to identify it on the basis of your previous perceptual experience as a tree. That is sannyā, not simply perception, but rather the identification of the perception as a perception of a particular item. Of course, the actual process of perception and recognition is usually so swift as to make it impossible to distinguish between the purely perceptual element and the element of recognition. But moments of ambiguity do occur, especially in unfamiliar surroundings or light conditions, when you can be quite clear what your perception is without being able to label it securely. So, from the point of view of the Pali Canon, sannyā means recognition. The Mahayana, however, points out, much as does Bishop Berkeley, that we do not rest content with mere perception, or perception come identification, but that we mistakenly posit behind what we perceive an actual, definite, fixed entity, to which the particular colour, shape, smell, sound, and touch that we recognise pertain as attributes. The Buddhist position is thus essentially a nominalist one. Realism, by contrast, maintains that a tree is more than the sum total of the percepts you experience and interpret as a tree. Buddhism does not quite hold that the tree only exists in your own mind, but it does predicate that, even if there were a real tree existing independently of your own or anyone else's perceptions, there would be no way of verifying the fact. From the Buddhist perspective, therefore, further speculation on the matter is futile. What we are left with is awareness, and within that awareness or perception, a kind of differentiation into opposite poles, one of which can be identified as the object, the other as the subject. Clearly, however, these objects and subjects cannot be looked upon as discrete, separate, and independent. If the object were really separate from the subject, how would you be able to perceive it, or even know it was there? Buddhists tend to think not in terms of a world of discrete objects perceived by discrete subjects, but in terms of a world of perception, a world of experience, a world of awareness, luminous and radiant, which here and there darkens, thickens, or coagulates into various degrees of polarization, though we must guard against realist assumptions as we speak in those terms. Being supported by the notion of a sign is, therefore, relying on a fixed idea. In the case of giving gifts, it amounts to acting in accordance with a fixed idea of what dana is supposed to be. We could relate it to the third fetta, reliance on rules and rituals as ends in themselves. If we do such and such, then it signifies, it is the sign, that we are practicing dana. This way of proceeding is fine as far as it goes, but it is hardly free, spontaneous, natural, creative, in the way that dana paramita is. If we rely on rules and rituals as ends in themselves, we build a barrier between us and reality, and in fact this is a second barrier. Sometimes people imagine that there is just one barrier between us and reality, a barrier built out of language or signs. But even apart from language, we have a perception of things as things. Language just embodies, and in general arises out of, that perception. It is not that if there were no language we would perceive things as they really are. We would still be perceiving things, and things are not realities. So there is a double barrier between us and reality. Not only do we perceive things, we also use words in relation to things, and indeed to beings, and that simply reinforces our view of those things or beings as representing realities. And why? Because the heap of merit of that Bodhi being, who, unsupported, gives a gift, is not easy to measure. What do you think, Subhuti? Is the extent of space in the East easy to measure? Subhuti replied, No, indeed, O Lord. The Lord asked, In like manner, is it easy to measure the extent of space in the south, west, or north, downwards, upwards, in the intermediate directions, in all the 10 directions, all round? Subhuti replied, No, indeed, O Lord. The Lord said, Even so, the heap of merit of that Bodhi being, who, unsupported, gives a gift, is not easy to measure. That is why, Subhuti, those who have set out in the Bodhisattva vehicle should give gifts without being supported by the notion of a sign. So why should the Bodhisattva give without any ulterior motive? This is the question the Buddha asks. The answer he gives himself, because the merit that accrues to the Bodhisattva is, in this way, is immeasurable, is an example of the short-cutting logic of this sutra. It is, in a sense, inconsequential. The argument does not develop in a linear manner at all. That you are going to be rewarded with unlimited merit cannot be the motivation for an act essentially characterized as being unspotted by self-interest. Words like why, therefore, and because appear here like ghosts of a reason-bounded world that this text has left far behind. Reason is left behind, however, not because it is unnecessary, but because ultimately it has its limitations. There is no devaluation of reason being implied here. The intellect does not have direct access to ultimate truth, but at no point does the perfection of wisdom suggest that the intellect can be dispensed with. And yet sometimes the impression one gets from Zen, or rather from Western interpreters of Zen, is that one first of all works oneself up into a state of intellectual confusion, and then just jettisons it all with the introduction of a droll little Zen story. This is offered as the way the intellect gets into difficulties and the way Zen transcends them. But real dichotomies, real intellectual koans, that bring one to the frontiers of the intellect, need to be distinguished from the sort of mental confusion which is certainly not inherent in the intellect itself. Strictly speaking, intellectual confusion is a contradiction in terms, but which arises from playing around with rarefied concepts. If you want to see how a real thinker works out his antonymies, you must go to Kant. But you don't solve bad metaphysics with irrationalism. If this seems daunting, you have to remind yourself that it is your own intellect that you have to transcend, not Kant's or Nagarjuna's. The point is that you overrun the positions of reason, you don't just retreat from them. It is not as if you can just kick away your intellect because you don't want to have to cope with it anymore. If you kick it away, you're kicking the ladder from under you. An enlightened being is not an intellectual capon. This all might seem quite obvious, but the effects of pseudo-Zen have been wide-ranging and disastrous, so it is perhaps necessary to say it. Within a traditional Buddhist context, merit, punya, is thought to be the result of good deeds performed in former lives, and to manifest in terms of your appearance, your health, your complexion, your beauty, the effect you have on other people, the fact that things come easily to you, and so on. Some people seem to be just lucky, while others fall over as soon as they set foot outside the door. According to popular Buddhist belief, you may actually build up a store of merit for the future. The most effective way of doing this is by making offerings to monks, by feeding them, usually overfeeding them, and giving them robes and performing pujas. A good bhikkhu is regarded in some countries as a sort of merit-making machine. Put a rupee in the slot and out comes a little packet of merit. If you feel that you have a great deal of catching up to do, you may even start constructing monasteries and stupas. Punya is personified in popular Theravadin Buddhism in the form of the Punya Devata, or merit god, a sort of personal guardian angel hovering over you. I doubt whether it is a canonical conception, although there is always the possibility with the Theravada of an essentially poetic idea being taken literally. To be fair, the Theravadins are generally not as literalistic as the Brahmins, while the Brahmins in their turn are, as a rule, no match for the Jains when it comes to missing the point in this way. There was an Indian Jain ascetic I heard about once, who woke up one day and decided he'd had enough of being an ascetic. Having accumulated a great deal of merit over the years, he sold it to another ascetic and set himself up in business with the proceeds. Putting aside the idea of merit as producing objective consequences for a moment, it is more than feasible that the idea of merit from good deeds performed in this life would have a strong psychological payoff in terms of building self-confidence. But on a spiritual level, it means essentially the positive emotional experience that comes to you as a result of living a thoroughly skillful life, quite apart from any expectation of future rewards. Merit modifies your being. You become a better person. It is like doing physical exercise. It is not that bigger muscles are your reward. You are just left with the natural result of your actions, which is that you have changed. Your muscles are bigger. The amount, so to speak, of merit you acquire from giving is related to the degree to which you act without being supported anywhere. The more disinterestedly you function, the more positive your emotional state becomes. A straightforward way to begin this apparently sophisticated practice of responding generously but disinterestedly to a situation, that is, without being determined by that situation, would be to transfer our giving from conventional occasions like Christmas or Mother's Day, when gifts are expected or even demanded of us, to occasions when we can respond into a more genuine and positive desire to give. At the same time, this is not to say that we have to wait for some inner urge to arise before starting to give. If this practice is to work, we have to put the objective needs of people before the authenticity or otherwise of our generosity. It is more important that someone who is cold or hungry should get what they need than that we should feel good about giving it to them. When someone who is not a bodhisattva gives, however, there will eventually be a reaction. The altruism turns sour, or at least becomes strained, if one is not appreciated. One gets a little resentful, hurt, and disappointed. So then one knows that one is not yet a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva experiences no tension of this kind, because there is no real experience of giving anything to anyone. So long as we look upon the bodhisattva as a fixed, separate individual, in the same way that we look upon ourselves, there is clearly going to be no possibility whatsoever of such a being giving gifts in such a way that he or she is not supported by the notion of a sign. The more merit you gain, the less of a separate person there is there to collect it. And when you hit the jackpot, infinite merit, there is no one there at all to scoop it up. We are standing in the way of our own accumulation of merit all the time. We have only to get out of the way for the merit to come pouring through. Giving is innate. We are innately void, innately pure, innately generous. Looking beyond the realm of individual psychology, we may realize our innate generosity at a metaphysical level of being when we also realize our innate voidness. If to be a bodhisattva is natural, to practice dana is natural.